The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning. As probably many of you know, in kind of the wider spiritual religious circles of humanity, there's often very strong distinctions made that kind of fit into the category of spiritual and non-spiritual, material and spiritual, inner and outer, things like that. And so in the teachings of the Buddha, there's a similar distinction that's made, and it has to do with the feelings a person can have. And the distinction is that between, known translators translates this term, I'll tell you in a minute what it is in Pali, as worldly and of the world and not of the world, which other religions also have this idea. And some translators take the same term and translate it as spiritual and non-spiritual. The word that's being translated is sa-amisa and nir-amisa. So sa means with, and amisa literally means flesh, and nir-amisa means not of the flesh. So I've never seen a translator do this for the Buddhist terms, but it could be almost like carnal feelings and non-carnal feelings. Feelings of the flesh, feelings of not of the flesh. And feelings here, primarily, it doesn't refer to emotions like we think of it, but they're related to, not necessarily emotions, but to mental states. And we'll see, I'll talk about that as we go along here. And feelings have to do with something much more primary than emotions, and that is whether an experience feels pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant, whether it feels painful, involves painful or pleasure. And so there's pleasures of the flesh, and there's pleasures of that's not of the flesh. There's pleasures of that are not spiritual in a sense, and pleasures which are spiritual. And I know that some people are quite uncomfortable with this kind of split, this kind of duality, and it lends itself sometimes to this idea that one part of the divide is somehow wrong and bad, and you shouldn't have it, especially when you talk about pleasures of the flesh. You know, some people are kind of against that. What might work as a translation is rather more close to the idea of flesh is to translate it as this distinction in Buddhism between sensual pleasure and non-sensual pleasure. Because what's being referred to here is the differences between those pleasures that come through our senses, the five senses, that involve pleasure or involve pain. So those sensations. But there's a whole other category of pleasure that a person, or pain that a person can experience, which doesn't belong to what we experience through our five senses, but rather belong to something that's felt inwardly. Exactly what sense door, how that's perceived, isn't exactly referred to, but it's recognized that we can know, there can be a knowing that recognizes both pleasure and pain, pleasure and discomfort, that is inward, inside, not belonging to the world of direct senses. Maybe in a modern, very lightly in a modern kind of vocabulary, we could talk about maybe physical pleasures and psychological pleasures. Maybe. This is pre-Freud, back in the time of the Buddha. So they didn't have the word psychology in the way we have it. So there's two kinds of pleasures. And and one of the tasks of mindfulness practice is to be able to recognize each of them as it's occurring. Because in mindfulness practice, the idea is to recognize everything and see it clearly what's happening. And it's not really with a value judgment one over the other, but there's a lot of wisdom that can come from recognizing that distinction. And there are people who who have very little sense or awareness of the inner spiritual pleasures or the inner pleasures of the path or the practice that can happen. And so they kind of keep looking for pleasure or satisfaction in their sense experience. And sometimes even, kind of the analogy I'm kind of thought about in this regard is that it's kind of like maybe you've ever gone walking or driving in the fog, and it's really thick. And, you know, it's pretty consequential. You know, you have to kind of really stay focused to see where you're walking. So there's a lot of attention is given to look really carefully, kind of see whatever details you can see so you don't step on something or run into something. And so the fog might clear. And if the habit of searching and looking really intently continues, then a person might still be focusing very intently to try to see now that it's clear. Look at the details of what's ahead down the road or the path as you walk. Maybe not because of the habit, not recognizing that you no longer need to be so focused. And it's possible now to actually relax the focus, not strain so much, and maybe even to actually see better in a fogless environment, because you're better off seeing kind of the much wider, bigger picture of what's happening than the narrow focus that you need to kind of do the best you can to pick out some details in the fog. But then it's possible to notice that in that strain to get say, really, really focused when there's no longer fog, that focus constricts the attention. That focus keeps the mind somewhat constricted or tight or straining as it's trying to accomplish or do something or want something. But if a person doesn't recognize that, that's what's going on, then they might not relax that strain. And they might keep kind of trying to look focus quite strongly. Maybe another analogy would be like if you're walking, and it's really important to walk somewhere, perhaps you're walking. And then you come along a conveyor belt, and it goes along just nicely, and so it takes a while to realize that you could stop walking because the conveyor belt is carrying you, and perhaps once you're on the conveyor belt, it occurs to you to look around more, and notice the environment in the way that maybe you aren't if you're focusing on walking and where you're going. So sometimes the focus on pleasures of the senses becomes a very strong habit of people to try to look for their well-being, look for their happiness through making themselves comfortable or getting stimulated in a sensual way. And there's nothing wrong with that, but it sometimes can result in overlooking a whole other form of pleasure that is available to us. So in the Buddhist tradition, this pleasure is called the pleasure near amissa, not of the flesh pleasure. So, and also there's not of the flesh pain, discomfort. So the way that the Buddhist tradition defines or recognizes this non-flesh-like or non-sensual pleasure is as the pleasure that arises from meditation practice. And so if you sit in meditation and you get somewhat concentrated and settled, there can arise within you, kind of, without any kind of, you know, without anybody giving you a massage or having a strawberry or looking at some beautiful thing, there can arise this inner sense of happiness or delight or pleasure or well-being that is independent of our senses being stimulated. And that well-being is what's referred to as this non-sensual pleasure. Some, you know, it's not that unusual to have it, except that some people will confuse the pleasure of the senses with an inner sense of pleasure and well-being. And that's probably one of the reasons why some people get addicted or get really focused on having sensual pleasure. Especially I think of it when there's a certain kind of euphoria with having sensual pleasure. And that euphoria can lend itself to a strong sense of energy and well-being that feels like it's internal and large, you know, inside, but it's really kind of it's arising and coming from the intensity of the sensual experience we're having, And so in that regard, I know people who will go pursue sensual pleasure in order to have that inner sense of well-being, to get something, the chemicals going or something going that makes them feel kind of good inside. I see it sometimes on meditation retreats where occasionally, not everyone who does this, but occasionally there are people who insist that they have to continue running every day on the retreat because only then will they feel really good. And because running can make you feel really good, but you know, there's this inner kind of, I don't know what it is, surge of serotonin or some kind of dopamine or something nice that's kind of flowing nicely. And so there is a feeling of inner well-being that can rise from that. But it's an inner well-being, I think, from the Buddhist analysis that comes from this outer stimulation of doing the running. And so then in order to have it, a person has to then go back into the world, in a sense, and run again to get this kind of stimulation. And what's, I think, quite wonderful is to have the capacity to feel this inner sense of well-being without having to require anything in the world to change or do anything in the world. It gives a person a lot of power or strength or confidence that that it's fine to be alive and be present without needing to get some kind of external satisfaction. To be nothing wrong with external satisfaction, but if that's the primary and only thing a person is focusing on, then maybe it's a little bit like the person in the who hasn't noticed that the fog has lifted, and part of the function of meditation can be to realize that the fog lifts, the fog is lifted. And one of the part of the fog that we lift is the fog in our mind. And so to help that kind of loosen up. Interestingly, in this early tradition, they also refer to pain, so this dichotomy between pain and pleasure, the pain of the non-physical world or the non-sensual world, this inner pain. And the way they define it there is a person who has a yearning or desire for spiritual well-being and happiness, but can't access it or can't pursue it for some way. Or they have a sense of knowing that's a possibility, but they can't, somehow their life is too busy or their mind is caught up in things and they can't do those activities which might bring it. So, for example, I've known people who've had that, have a really strong sense of wanting that inner freedom that's possible, the inner sense of satisfaction that's possible. But the only way they know how to do that is to maybe go on meditation retreats. And so that's really important for them, but the responsibilities in their life keep them from doing that. And so there's a certain kind of inner pain that comes from that. Certainly the hope is that we don't have to rely on meditation retreats to feel it. And I think that's one of the... When as a teacher, I see someone who is depending on meditation retreats to have some inner well-being, then I'll try to direct them in some other direction to see something else. So this distinction between this inner sense of well-being and outer sense of well-being, and the way this inner sense of well-being is pointed to or accessed or developed in the early tradition is through meditation practice. So some people might now protest because it sounds like it's too much focus on the inner life. Because, the inner and outer life, and these Buddhists, here we are again. just this inner life and, leaving people around, leaving people out. And then there's these people who, at least some people here on Friday know that there are some people who don't feel like they should be involved with the outer world and people at all, right? And just meditate. But we heard a lot about on Friday why that's not a good idea. Some of us are still learning, right? How many of you were here Friday? Some of you were here? A lot of you. The rest of you can talk to them. So what's interesting, what interestingly happens, though, and this is where it is that as, where this inner sense of well-being or pleasure that comes from meditation or comes from going inside, there's this wonderful alchemy that happens, where if you go inside, you come out. If you go inside, it opens up to something quite expansive and inclusive. Sometimes if you go into the world pursuing certain things, like the world's going to do it for me, I just want pleasure, I'm going to do something. Sometimes the alchemy works the other way, that it actually doesn't actually open you to the world, but actually closes you to the world. So it's called sometimes kind of the alchemy of reversal, that you get the opposite of what you're trying to look for. And so with meditation practice, as we for example, you can go inwards and start focusing and concentrating on your breathing, and that seems pretty inner. But as the mind gets focused on the breath and settled on the breath, what happens is the fog of the mind begins to clear, or the distractions of the mind, or things we're caught up in our minds, the preoccupations of the mind, the strong feelings that we're involved in and caught in, begin to settle down. And as they begin settling down and able to stay more present for the breath, unified, collected, composed on not only the breath but the present moment, then it gives a chance for this inner sense of well-being to show itself, almost as if it's always there waiting for you. It's a matter of just kind of being able to settle enough, clear the fog so you can see it, what's there. And as that happens, the state of the mind changes. The quality of the mind begins to change. And it changes from being a contracted mind to an expansive mind. And so one of the instructions in mindfulness practice and time from the Buddha is to notice the distinction between a contracted mind and an expansive mind. So this is interesting because some people don't, you know, never kind of consider this. They're so much focusing on, you know, on the details of the fog, through the fog, than they are in their mind. But so one of the exercises that I give people occasionally, mindfulness exercise, is to notice sometime, maybe through meditation or some other situation, when you feel really relaxed in a nice, good way, relaxed, calm, peaceful. And in that relaxed, calm, peaceful state, then at that point, look at the state of your mind, the quality of the mind, your thinking mind, the mind that's aware. What's it like? What does it feel like? How is it in that relaxed state? And just whatever way you can, get a sense of it, a visceral sense of it. And then you kind of register that, kind of try to let that kind of, you know, register really well in you. And then go about your life. And then look for an opportunity when you're really caught up in some preoccupation. Really, maybe even better if you're upset. Don't get yourself upset for this exercise, but, you know, it might happen sooner or later that something like this happens. When you really get really kind of locked into some preoccupation and concern. And when that happens, take a look and see what your mind feels like then. And then recall, you know, the memory of what it felt like when you were relaxed. And compare and contrast those two states of mind. And even better, if you can watch the preoccupation happen. See what happens, the shift and change. I've sometimes sat in meditation and been kind of relaxed and nice. It's very good. And then for some reason or other, that I don't know usually, I have a really significant thought. Significant enough that I just lock into it. And my emotions rise and my feelings rise and I just kind of like, and the contrast between the relaxed state and the kind of boom, you know, like if I sit there quietly, peacefully, and some car goes by and the car sounds just like the car of my high school girlfriend when she jilted me. And suddenly, you know, there's a change inside. And so that contrast of the change is interesting. So when I give this kind of exercise to people, what some people will report is that when the mind gets kind of zeroed in and fixated on some thought or preoccupation, the mind feels like it gets smaller. When the mind is relaxed, it feels like it's larger. It feels like it's more constricted. When it's preoccupied, when it's not preoccupied, it feels more expansive. Some people even describe it as suddenly the mind got dark. Before it felt kind of light. Transparent or open. And that's another way people describe it, open and closed. It feels like something closed, whereas before something was quite open. And so the instructions for the mindfulness instructions of the Buddha is, again, without any judgment about one is better than the other, there's a very clear recognition. You're asked to clearly recognize the state of the mind, and is it contracted, or is it expansive? Is it narrow or is it large? Is it small or is it big? And down through the ages, a lot of Buddhist teachers like to use the language of small mind and big mind. And sometimes it refers to the ways of thinking. Small-minded is when you're kind of selfish, and big-minded is when you're much more open and expansive. But it also has to do with a quality, a felt sense, a way of experiencing the mind. Sometimes the mind is feels very small or contracted, and so, like you somehow, who you are is a small little tight bundle inside the skull. And other times the mind feels quite expansive, and it's not bounded even by the skull, the mind or the boundaries of the body. But it feels more like, you know, it expands outwards and opens out in a boundless kind of way. And so here's where this alchemy of reversal happens. Focus inwardly on the breath, for example, or something on yourself in some mindful way, and get settled on that and stop being distracted from it and kind of stop reacting to what's going on and just be there in a simple way. Then that affects the mind. The mind begins to relax and to open. And then it kind of opens up to this large mind, this big mind. And that big mind is no longer just focused inwardly. The feeling of that big mind is that it's inclusive, that now you're in the world and you're including everything, you're including everybody. It's as if there's no boundaries or barriers between you and others, you and the world. And that experience of not having boundaries and barriers is an experience that gives a sense of intimacy, gives a sense of loving kindness, of compassion, of feeling connected to others in a very nice way. It's a feeling of being connected that's very different than the kind of connection that comes from needing someone or holding on or, you know, trying to get pleasure from someone. The pleasure that kind of just being kind of just very open and relaxed and present for the world around us and others. In the early tradition, again, this experience of the expansive mind is very closely connected to the feelings of loving kindness and compassion, as if somehow those come together. So there's this movement to go in, the inner sense of well-being, and that itself opens up to a wonderful way of being connected and involved in the world. So the last thing I'll say is give you an example for me personally for today. And maybe this is interesting to hear. So this morning, at some point, I was looking something up that concerned me in the wider world. And I saw that someone had made a decision that affected me and had posted it on the wide world web that they hadn't talked to me about it. And so my response, my reaction, was to feel hurt, disappointed, and angry. And I would say anger was the predominant emotion. So what did I do? So the first thing I did was I just kind of stayed with my thinking and tried to think about what this was about, tried to understand it in the best way I could, tried to get to the best understanding, most wisest understanding I could of both what might have happened and what was the wisest way to relate to this. And it took a little while to be able to think and reflect and come to some understanding that I felt, you know, that at least provisionally was a, till I had more information, provisionally was probably a wise way of thinking about this. And however, thinking wisely about it is different than feeling wisely, right? That didn't take care of my anger. I was still kind of, you know, angry. So I got really quiet. This is kind of my way, it's one way that I have. I got quiet, and then I went into my anger. And the language I like to use lately for doing something like this is I inhabited my anger in a quiet, safe place. I mean, it wasn't like I was, you know, giving free rein to my anger. But I went inside to really, this idea of going in to it, to allow it, to kind of inhabit, to live inside of it, was what I wasn't going to resist it or try to block it. And I wasn't going to be mindful kind of from a distance, like I was thinking mindfulness, like I know it's there and naming it and seeing it. But the idea was to enter into the flesh, enter into the felt sense, physical aspect of where I felt anger, where the energy was in my body. And And then as I did that, together with the feelings of contraction, of tightness, that I energy, of heat that I was feeling, as I focused on it that way, it started to I started then to be in touch with an expansive feeling of well-being. As if those two can exist, coexist. And I started feeling, yes, there's more than just the anger here. As I'm using my attention, my awareness, to be fully present as I could for it, my sense of boundaries, my sense of kind of contracted sense of self or small mind began to relax. And then I started feeling this very delightful, satisfying feeling of it was much more expansive and open. My feeling of anger didn't change dramatically. It began to diminish some, but it began to shift the whole ecology. There was more going on in the picture. There was more information, more happening. I was no longer just an angry person. I was now a person who had anger, and if I was going to identify with anything, I started to identify with it as a person who was feeling much more open and expansive. And then with time, you know, then within a short amount of time, for me, that anger began to dissipate and settle away, it wasn't really a big issue anymore. And now I just have to wait to see whether my wisest possible thinking can help me negotiate this issue in a wise way. But at least now I feel like that I'm not going to be kind of do something foolish or say something that will be misunderstood, because I'm speaking from the anger. So this idea of going inward to really be present for the experience of what's there, and then there's this wonderful alchemy that can happen if something settles and opens up, and that opening up makes us available to the world in a different way, This idea in Buddhism of the non-sensual well-being, pleasure, the non-sensual joy that a person can experience, non-sensual happiness, is not something that disconnects us from the world, but rather I think it helps us open to the world, feel the world, receive the world, kind of intimacy to the world, in this expansive, wide mind that's possible. So that's what was on my thought today, on my mind today. And I don't know what that was like for you to hear. I don't know if it contracted you or expanded you or confused you. But maybe we have about over 10 minutes if someone wants to say something about the talk or ask a question. Maybe it'd be nice to have some discussion.
Okay. I have two questions. The first is, can you get that kind of expansiveness from some interactions of the flesh, like a connection with another person, just in a very intimate kind of kind way? Can you get that same kind of expansiveness? And then the other one is just, what's the difference? Can you say a little more about the difference between getting locked into something and then focusing on the feeling like you did?
Okay, so can you feel this expansive sense of inner well-being and big mind in connection to some other person? And I think to answer that question, I think we have to be careful to be able to distinguish different ways that are different we can feel expansive or different kind of ways. So as I said earlier, sometimes there's a certain kind of euphoria that can come from sensual pleasure, for example. You can have intense sensual pleasure from someone and have wonderful sex. And afterwards, a certain kind of euphoria that can feel. Some people say it's very much spiritual, very spiritual feeling. But is it in fact that? Is it reliable, or is it really kind of the chemicals and stuff that are flowing through that happen? Or maybe it depends a little bit on how it's approached, how the connection with someone else is approached. If in the way we're connecting with someone, it's helping us to open up to a relaxed, expansive, open mind, then perhaps it's very similar. But if what's really so it's what the cause of the sense of openness is not necessarily the, not the person, but the way we're relating to the person gets us to relax and to open, perhaps. But if what if the strong feeling of kind of this inner well-being that wells up that feels expansive, if the cause of it has been sensual stimulation, intense sensual stimulation, then I think it's not quite. Then it wouldn't be the same. So that's what. So that distinction I think is important. Rather than say yes or no to you,
it depends. Like a moment of kindness or
moment of kindness. Yeah. I think again, I think it depends on how it's evaluated and how it's received. I could maybe receive someone's kindness. They're being kind and generous to me, and how I receive it is I could actually close down. Oh no, now I'm obligated to Or I could say, boy, this is my lucky day. I was just hoping for that. and so I feel really good, but, because it satisfies my desires. Or I can touch something inside. I can resonate with something inside that kind of softens something beautiful and connects. So I think it all depends on how it's received or how it's offered and given, what's going on. And then, see, the second one was?
Just the difference between locking onto thoughts and as you describe, going into your anger or just focusing on the anger until it dissipates.
The difference, well, I think it's a dramatic difference. If you're angry and focusing on your story and rehearsing it and reviewing it and over again, it's very repetitive and cyclic, and it can just be fueling and adding fuel to the fire. So I think it's very, very useful to be mindful of what's going on in our thinking. To start seeing if the thinking is useful or not. And a lot of people never consider, is this useful thinking? It's just like they take thinking for granted. And one way you know it's useful is if you've thought basically the same thing 10 times in a row. Then I think you can have fairly reliable that probably this is not useful, and maybe you should come back to it after you've done something else. See if you can come from a different angle.
I think, is this on? Okay. I think I'm interested in the next installment. What happens then when you begin to deal with the issue after you've calmed down? I think for me, that's the hardest part because I come up against this feeling that I know they're going to do it again. It's happened again and again and again. So how do I approach the person after I've done the work that you described?
It's a great question, and I feel, quite hesitant to answer because it's so varied depending on the situation. So many different strategies, and two things occur to me in the little kind of hint that you gave me, that they keep coming back and doing it over and over and over again. One possibility is you don't give them another chance. sometimes that might be wise. And the other is to tell them that directly and say, I have this issue. It seems like you keep doing this over and over and over again. I've even talked to you about it, but it keeps happening. I think that we need to talk about the repetitiveness nature of this kind of behavior, what you're saying. Can we kind of talk about what's going on? Can I let you know? Can I tell you what's happening with me when this happens? And if they say no, that tells you a lot about them and whether what you need to do then further. Did you pass the mic? Or do you? Yeah.
You talked about having the feeling of anger, and then you had the time. You had the luxury of time, really, to pause and think and feel and meditate, really, or contemplate. I'm not sure what's the right verb.
All of the above, whatever it
okay.
takes.
And listening to it, my first thought was, but what do I do when I have to do something in the instant? Now, the first answer that came to me is a lot of times I realize I could ask for time. Well, let me get back to you on that. But still, in my work, there's times when I have to respond in the moment. And tempers are high around me, and I'm reacting. Any advice?
Yeah, my if with that kind of carte blanche, any advice?
Yes.
I would encourage you to focus on preparing yourself for those events, getting ahead of time. I mean, not just like thinking ahead, I'm going to a difficult meeting, but realizing that, you know, you're going to start now so that you're better prepared in 2 years, you know, for the difficult things then. Because this is a long training and involvement, but to really develop the inner stability, the strength of mindfulness, the ability to let go, the wisdom of really understanding yourself well, skills of how to speak wisely, and you know, practical skills of speaking, skills in restraint. Restraint is a great capacity, you know. So you don't, you know, and so start cultivating, developing all those, so that when you come up to a point of crisis like that, all that's available and right there. To expect those things to be there if you haven't trained yourself is not going to be very, very helpful.
So come here more often. This is where I get my training.
Yeah, if this is where you get it, please do. And then you know, because you can't necessarily wait 2 years and some of the things, right? So you need some advice before then. The simple thing maybe that is learn to practice restraint. Learn to be able to not give in to an impulse, and then at least then maybe you won't make mistakes. Yes, please. Oh, who's next? Oh, you have the mic, so why don't you go ahead and pass that mic to Jim. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'm wondering if you could say a little more about the alchemy of reversal thing. I can certainly relate to the obsessing on anger and having the same thought 10 times, but I'm not quite sure on how that can lead to an expansive or benign state.
Not thinking about it. So what I did was I spent some time. I felt like I needed to think and come to a better understanding of this. So I did my best for a little while. To just this morning to think about the situation, what might have happened, how best to understand it, how best to understand various options I had, how to respond. And some of my thoughts were not very wise, but that was really good to spend time looking at my thoughts and evaluating them and trying to, you know, what's the best, wisest understanding with what's going on. And sometimes it's helpful to talk to someone else. Actually, I talked to my wife a little bit this morning as well, and that was helpful to kind of hear myself say things to her and get her reflections back. So I spent some time with the thinking, and that was helpful, at least I thought that was important. But that didn't really help me to an expansive mind or to relax mind. What helped me then was to bring the mindfulness into the direct felt sense experience of the anger, where I felt in my body. And then to kind of, where I found it was my body, it was kind of in my front of my chest and in my arms primarily. I kind of entered into that part of my body. It's like I went from the inside of it. Rather than looking at it from the outside, I inhabited it, or I entered into the middle of it and felt it from the inside, like I was being that almost. And rather than reacting to it or with it or anything. And then I just stayed there with it. Because if I'm staying in the body with it, then I'm not adding a story to it, which is often how it gets fueled and continued. And also, that I'm closer in touch with where the holding might be physically. And then because I stayed present, often presence, being present for something, allows something to unfold. And so then it began to unfold, began to loosen or move. And then that movement and loosening was what gave access to the wider, more expansive mind. Does that make some sense?
Yes, thank you.
Jim had his hand up, if you could. No? No, okay.
We went off topic a little bit.
Okay.
I thought about sort of where we're going with this.
Okay, then maybe last one, and then we'll stop.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you about inhabiting the inhabiting the emotion or the body that you speak of. So myself, sometimes I could do that. Sometimes I can't. It's almost like my body's pushing whatever reflects, whatever awareness I have. It's pushing against that. And thought continues. Yeah, so it's a little bit difficult to explain what's going on, because if I could explain it, I'd probably...
Well, I don't quite understand either, but let me explain, offer you something. So like with anger. So today it worked very well for me to just kind of be quiet and be with the anger. But there have been times in the past where that didn't seem like the right thing to do with it. It wasn't how to be with it. And what I found was really useful for me was to go for a long, vigorous walk. And I just would walk and walk and walk. And in that situation, I would let my mind think whatever it wanted to think. I wasn't trying to find the wise thinking. I just gave a lot of freedom to everything, to the feelings, to the emotions, to the thoughts. But I was paying attention and trying to see. And as I had this, I was kind of doing that, giving us freedom. And the walking, the movement of the walking seems to let the energy flow and move and just be there. And I wasn't trying to do anything with it. I wasn't trying to make it go away or enter into it. I was just letting it be, letting it be. If anything, the mindfulness was kind of get out of the way of it, just so it could kind of be there. And this was up in the woods, far away in the mountains. It was pretty safe. No one's not going to run into anybody. And then I would pay very careful attention to try to see, where is this coming from? Where's the emotional source of this? Where's the emotional source of this? And it wouldn't be obvious at all, but I just kept an eye open for that. What's going on here in being angry? What's going on in terms of the story and all that, but what other feelings, what other emotions are here as part of it? And then what would happen is that it would be I would see something I hadn't seen before, and for me it was usually either I'd see that I was hurt, or that I was afraid. And then once I saw once I could identify the fear or the hurt that seemed to be underlie the anger, then it was a whole different universe. Then I could go home. Because then it was everything had shifted and I understood something that was more useful to address. And
that makes a lot of sense.
So I hope this was interesting today or useful, and it might be interesting for you to reflect, consider this distinction between an inner well-being and outer well-being, or inner pleasure or joy and outer pleasure and joy. And to what degree that distinction is relevant for you, or you have some reference point for it or experienced it. How is it you experience this inner well-being that opens up to an expansive mind? Is that something you have access to or have known, or what ways do you have access to it? And if you have some access to it, even if it's a mild feeling, it wasn't dramatic when I did it with my anger, right? But it was just very nice. There was this different thing going on. If it happens even in small degrees, how can you avail yourself of that more often through the day as you go about your day? What would it take to kind of more often tap into that? Because I would suggest that it's always there waiting for you. So, thank you.